Now, for this talk this evening, in defence of Cork's political culture, the dates I have are a little bit more extended than 1919 to 22, circa 1914 to 22. So I take it in that time span. Firstly, I must, as you have to do these days, declare an interest in case you're accused of being partial, biased, or God knows what. So to declare an interest, I have to say that in 1920, and from that time on, circa 1920, 1928, well, 1918 to 1928, my father was living in St. Luke's Cross, Cork, and going to school at Christian's and studying medicine at UCC. So that is one particular Cork background. The other thing, which is possibly even more serious, that his own family came from Rusnakilla to Relton, and his grandfather from Inchigila. And from what I gather, both those locations are fairly near a certain ambush site. So I visit the site with, I suppose, that I have a certain prejudice, if you like, a certain sympathy towards it, possibly reflected by my uncle, Bill, who died and is buried in Leytonstone Cemetery, and saw fit to have put on the gravestone, William Murphy, originally from Kilmichael. So, having declared that, we'll say a bit more. The title of this, it's partly to link in with the theme of Cork's Year of Culture, but also it reflects Daniel Corkery, in his introduction to the life of Thomas McCurtain. He reflected on the ideals of McCurtain, McSweeney and O'Hegarty. And writing of them and of other Irish people, he said, "Of ourselves and our own upbringing, we cannot but know that in that background was a long-descended traditional way of life, not a thing without foundation or without a history, and mostly a cultural history at that." So I'm trying to examine the way in which the historical, traditional past moulded the political present in those years. And I think the word defence will take on a meaning during the talk. In regards to the scope, I have tried, as I was requested, to make a certain focus on Cork and Cork people, which try to do that. And I possibly do it in the same way. Obviously, the Irish dimension comes into it. I'll try to do it in the words or the way of Maura Brewer McSweeney, the daughter of Terence McSweeney, who was here recently and spoke, and at the re-edition of her father's Principles of Freedom, which was a great occasion. But she tells the story of a pilgrimage to Rome, and some people from Cork being on the pilgrimage and being met by Italians, who all they knew of Ireland was of McSweeney. So they all rushed and were very pleased to meet this group from Cork from McSweeney. And they then asked the group, "Is Ireland in Cork?" They were so convinced that the only thing about Ireland was Cork and McSweeney. Now, this talk is a little bit in the reverse, but I do have to bring Ireland in and the Cork dimension in that way. And lastly, as regards location, it's fitting to be in this hotel because, as I understand it, it was the last place on the 21st of August where Michael Collins stayed before his death on the 22nd. And we do hope to show a film, an original film, of Michael Collins in 1919 launching the Dáil Éireann Leanúna. But as a word of introduction, the consideration of any historical theme, I think, requires that it be seen in context, in time and in place. And by chance, I was reading through an American commission on evidence of conditions in Ireland and encountered the evidence of a Miss Ellen C. Wilkinson from Manchester, who visited Cork City on the 11th of October 1920, and she stayed in this hotel. Her two-week visit to Ireland was made as part of a small group of 10 women representing the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. They were on a fact-finding mission to Ireland. Of her stay in Cork, Miss Wilkinson wrote, "We got to Cork at a very tense moment. We asked the driver to drive us to a hotel right near the City Hall. He protested violently, but he finally took us to the Imperial Hotel right near the city centre. Curfew was at 10 o'clock. She didn't observe the curfew too well. She looked out of the window and she declared she saw soldiers in extended formation, each one of them wearing tin helmets, the shrapnel type of helmets, and carrying guns with fixed bayonets. And then came three armoured cars packed with soldiers. And then after them came a lorry which had petrol in it." That was her impression of Cork at that time. She herself and many of the other group had an interesting background, and they were reporting generally of events in Ireland. This particular reflection of hers, I think, is important for the gist of this talk. Wilkinson herself was a Wesleyan Methodist, and as her brother was a Wesleyan Methodist, she was given introductions to ministers in Ireland. She found, quotation, "that they entirely ridiculed the idea that the Southern Unionists were in any danger from the Southern population, and generally speaking, they were much more fearful of what the Crown forces would do than what the Sinn Féin forces would do." That was her observation. The women then drew up a formal report on the situation in Ireland. It maintained that the government's campaign against Sinn Féin was characterised by terrorism, the destruction of trade and industry, and by an anti-Irish propaganda which sustained the war effort. They also noted in the report that Dáil Éireann had the consent of the people. The report was equally clear that it was the aim of the British government to destroy Irish trade and industry, and by so doing force young men to emigrate. It also stated that the dissemination of a hate by means of propaganda, especially by the police journal, The Weekly Summary, was provoking armed conflict. That was her view from this hotel and from other experiences during, I think, their 3 weeks in Ireland. And I'd suggest that the sentiments of the report and the eyewitness accounts that accompany it was basically in accord with the traditional Irish interpretation of the interplay of events at that time. I'll now say a little bit about the traditional Irish historical narrative of the war. I think if one just reflects on the books that have come down to us and from which we used to take our Irish history, particularly of these revolutionary years, I'll just say them briefly. Dorothy McArdle's Irish Republic, the essays in Rebel Cork's Fighting Story from 1916 to the Truths, and possibly a journal less well known, but the Capuchin Annual for 1970, a special 50th anniversary commemorative issue in which there were four essays on Cork. These told a certain story of Ireland at that time. And the writers in the Capuchin Annual, for example, Florence O'Donoghue, on McCurtain, Lynch, both Liam Lynch and Diarmuid Lynch. Tom Barry wrote in the Capuchin Annual. Then we have his own books. Then lesser books or lesser known people, Micheál O'Sullivan, Where Mountainy Men Have Sown, and Kathleen Keyes MacDonald, which tell the story of years of conflict from a local perspective. Now, recent books, or relatively recent, Meadow Ryan, who happily to say is here, who's done so much to keep that tradition alive, her book recently republished on Liam Lynch, and also her recent book on Tom Barry, they would fit in broadly, although researched to a level that the early ones may not have been, with the exception of Florence O'Donoghue, who was a brilliant researcher. And then books from the Athol Press I mentioned, who are reproducing some from the Bureau of Military History, like Sean Moylan. Those books tell us a story which gives a narrative in which there's no dispute. When dispute did arise with Liam Deasy's Towards Ireland Free, and Tom Barry refuted it in Circa 1974, and the subtitle of his book, The Reality of the War, was Refutations, Corrections, and Comments on Liam Deasy's Towards Ireland Free. That did diminish the harmony and led to certain investigation, a proper investigation, over the details of the war. But having said that, they did accept, both men, and all of the involved in the dispute, what I would say the preface in the Capuchin Annuals 1970 issue. It read, "The Irish volunteers swore allegiance to the law, and under the Minister of Defence and General Headquarters staff, approved by him and the government executive, took up arms to defend their government and win the freedom of the Irish people to govern independently their own country and take their place among the free nations of the world. Irish men and women fought bravely and endured with exceptional courage a reign of terror authorised in Ireland by the British government that had few, if any, equals in the annals of history." That's the Capuchin Annual 1970. Now, to illustrate these sentiments, the Capuchin Annual had a sketch from a Breton artist, a man called Benesek, of Terence McSweeney dying, Lloyd George looking at him and saying, "It is too great for us, he is too great for us." It was too much for the British to deal with. And they also then had coloured reproductions of paintings, Patrick Toohey, the Irish volunteer, Sir John Lavery, the funeral of the Lord Mayor of Cork. One could mention, I think they came from the Crawford Gallery here, and Sean Keating's work, Men of the South and of the West. And they portrayed the volunteers in a sort of heroic mode, honest, brave, fearless. And the same story was told in the films, documentary films, Misha Era and Saoirse. So you have the situation that music and song, narrative, combined to make this historical narrative. And yet today, we have this other story, that Tom Barry killed British soldiers after they had surrendered. Tom Barry was a serial killer. His account of Kilmichael is riddled with lies and evasions. The revolution made Protestants fair game to any of their neighbours, whether angry or covetous. Now, the above descriptions are but some of the conclusions drawn by Peter Hart in his recent works on the period. They explain the presence of the word defence in the title of this talk. And Hart's conclusions will now be addressed. I'll try to address them. I was asked, as a little introduction qualification, to say something on, particularly on sectarianism, and in that regard then I haven't dealt extensively or hardly at all with the armed conflict, and I felt it was better, because those that have been working in this area have gone into the minutiae, and Meadow Ryan is here, who's gone into it more than most, or more than any, certainly over Kilmichael, to examine some basic premises that Peter Hart has adopted in engaging in his analysis of the IRA and the struggle in Ireland. So I'll say a bit on Peter Hart, youth culture, Sinn Féin and the Irish volunteers. The first step, as we know, is terribly important, whether it's in life or in research. And Peter Hart's research, the first step was to engage in a study, and the public work is entitled Youth Culture and the IRA, which was published in 1990, and it was published in the Trinity History Workshop. His other works, The IRA in Cork and The IRA at War, which have come out in the recent, since 1998, have developed his findings in that and in other areas. But in this first work, he draws comparisons between what was happening in youth culture and what was happening to the volunteers or the IRA. I'll give one or two quotations. The family resemblance between IRA operations and the actions of the Straw Boys is close and clear. The same use of masks or blackened or painted faces, often the same queer clothes, under the same size gangs of young bachelors, acting anonymously under a captain. Or you have where the Wren Boys acted in the name of the Ran, the King, the Volunteers acted in the name of the Republic. So that's the basic approach that he has in developing his analysis of the Volunteers. Several authors, or many, have followed him. I'll just name Just Augustine, also Trinity History Workshop, has developed an essay from 1990, which has a conclusion from a study of Mayo and Tipperary. With this conclusion, it appears that thorough, well-developed ideologies did not play a great part in the struggle. A more recent essay on Rebel Cork, 2004 by Gerard O'Brien, has several quotes, or many quotes, from Peter Hart, and you get conclusions like this: violence was a familiar feature of the pre-war political landscape in Cork. The close association of political expression and the need to physically assault one's opponent already existed in the Cork psyche. I don't quite know how to make that, but that's what the man says. So we're coming from that dimension. Not much ideology going into things, a lot of this youth culture. Another starting point, a different first step, would I suggest, have produced markedly different conclusions. Hart did briefly offer hope of an alternative avenue of approach, but it was not pursued. He cited Erskine Childers in the very first paragraphs of both his essay on youth culture and the subsequent essay on the social structure of the Irish Republican Army. The words of Childers about the Irish Volunteers were these, quotation, "The soul of the New Ireland, taken as a whole, the finest young men in the country, possessed with an almost religious enthusiasm for their cause, clean living and self-respecting." End of quotation. Significantly, having given the quotation, Hart chooses not to develop it. The quotation comes, as you would well know, from a former British serviceman and a Protestant, so an extremely interesting perspective. And ironically, the vast corpus of Childers' manuscripts, which I've sweated over myself, are in the manuscript room of Trinity College Library. So we have the strange irony of Trinity History Workshop pursuing its quest for an understanding of the Irish Revolution and neglecting possibly the most valuable source for its knowledge in its own library. A very interesting and disturbing development. I suggest it would be possible, from a different starting point, to come to completely different conclusions. It would be very easy to take something from Erskine Childers and develop a line of argument. But as we're in Cork, and I said I'd try and focus on Cork, I'll take a text, contemporary text from Cork, of Mary McSweeney. So I now say something about Mary McSweeney's view of Sinn Féin and the IRA at that time. On the 8th of December 1920, some 6 weeks after the death of her brother Terence, Mary McSweeney was publicly questioned about the state of Ireland and the early influences shaping her brother's life. Now, this was in the American Commission on Ireland, which was being held in America, an extremely valuable source. And she discussed with feeling and sentiment and expression the different formative influences of Terence McSweeney. I'll just list them. There's no mention of a youth culture, but she does mention the Celtic Literary Society, the Irish Industrial Development Association, which I think it's worth saying did develop, and maybe this is known in Cork, maybe not, it did develop in Cork the first national trademark instituted by any other country in the world. That's something of which Cork should be proud.